Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care Teleconference update on mantle cell lymphoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. We've had that collaboration for over 15 years in doing these lymphoma-based programs. And in addition to the Lymphoma Research Foundation's helping to spread the word about this program, we have a number of other organizations that have worked with us also to help tell you all about the program, and indeed, because of all of that and your interest in the topic, we have over 582 participants on the call today. So there are lots of you on the call today, and a lot of interest in mantle cell lymphoma, and we have participants not only from the United States, but we have international participants from Canada, Costa Rica, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's a bit of an international call. And now, today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants from the Lymphoma Research Foundation to the Lymphoma Research Foundation, from Celgene Corporation and Takeda Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program and really for the generosity of the Lymphoma Research Foundation in really making this program possible and helping to really plan it and be the architects for this program as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Brad Kahl. Dr. Kahl is Professor of Medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program, Siteman Cancer Center. Dr. Kahl is going to present an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, treatment options for newly diagnosed, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to really turn this program over to Dr. Kahl.
Thanks, Carolyn. And it's my pleasure to be speaking to everybody today. So I will get started with the overview of mantle cell lymphoma. So mantle cell lymphoma is a form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It is derived from a B, it's called a B lymphocyte. We have B cells and T cells and things called NK cells in our body. These are all lymphocytes that have different roles in our immune system. Mantle cell comes from a B lymphocyte. And kind of the genetic hallmark of mantle cell lymphoma is this thing called the 1114 translocation. Basically, what that means is little pieces of the chromosome on chromosome 11 and 14 swap for one another, and genes get misplaced in these cells. And this misplacement of these genes results in overexpression of a protein called cyclin D1. And cyclin D1 overexpression causes these B lymphocytes to grow in an abnormal fashion. They lose their normal regulation about when they're supposed to grow and not grow, stop, start, stop, start. They just grow in an abnormal way, and as a result, they start to accumulate in lymph nodes and in blood and in other organs, and that is really the initiating event in mantle cell lymphoma. Now, mantle cell lymphoma has some unique clinical features. For reasons we don't really understand, it is much more common in men than in women. There's about a 3-to-1 male predominance. It's generally a disease of older individuals. The average age is right around 65, although we do see occasionally young patients diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma, people in their 30s and 40s. Most people diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma have what we would call advanced stage disease. There's this staging system in lymphoma called the Ann Arbor staging system, and it gives stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. I think it's really important for folks not to put too much emphasis on this. Stage 4 in some cancers is a really big deal, and it's a bad thing. It's not really the case in lymphomas. People with stage 3 and 4 disease in lymphoma can do very well. So the stage just kind of tells us the extent of the lymphoma in a patient's body, but it doesn't mean we can't treat it. So I would say 85 or 90% of patients who have newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma will have stage 3 or 4 disease at diagnosis, so that's very common. It's very typical. The reason is mantle cell lymphoma typically involves the blood and the bone marrow, and if it's in the blood, that means it's everywhere by definition. The disease is everywhere, so that's normal for mantle cell lymphoma. The other place where it can be involved commonly is the gastrointestinal tract. We see that a lot in mantle cell lymphoma patients. Obviously, because it's a lymphoma, involvement of lymph nodes is very common, and so is spleen. So those are typical sites for mantle cell lymphoma to appear in a patient. It's pretty uncommon to have involvement of the central nervous system. That happens quite rarely in mantle cell lymphoma. The disease is moderately aggressive. I wouldn't say it's a highly aggressive lymphoma. We certainly have lymphomas that grow much more aggressively than mantle cell, although it is a lymphoma that is very hard to cure. And at least I in my practice don't talk in terms of cure when I'm treating mantle cell lymphoma patients, because I'm not sure cure is a realistic goal, at least with the treatments we have in 2016. We really think in terms of disease management and control when figuring out how to deal with the patient's mantle cell lymphoma. I will say that the prognosis for mantle cell lymphoma appears to have improved a lot in the last 15 years. There was a paper published about 7 years ago that proved this. It showed improvement that survival had basically doubled in the interval from the late 80s to the late 90s, and I suspect outcomes are even better now. It just takes a while to generate that kind of data, but we have better recognition of mantle cell lymphoma. We have better refinements in figuring out which patients should receive which treatments. And we have some new and exciting treatments for mantle cell lymphoma that weren't available a few years ago that Dr. Popowell will discuss. So when we have a patient who is newly diagnosed, we can do some things to estimate prognosis. There's something in mantle cell lymphoma called the MIPI, M-I-P-I. It looks at age, performance status, LDH, and white blood cell count. So that may be something that you may be interested in learning from your physician if you're a newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma patient, and it can give you some estimate on long-term outcome depending upon the MIPI score. There are also some biologic factors that can come into play, and the one that I think is worth remembering is something called the Ki-67 rate, or the proliferation rate. There's a simple, easy stain that the pathologist can do with the diagnostic tissue, and it tells us what proportion of the mantle cell lymphoma cells are cycling or dividing. And in mantle cell lymphoma, anything over 30% is considered high, and the prognosis is not as good when the Ki-67 is over 30%. And there was a new study that came out this past year that integrates the MIPI score with the Ki-67, and different risk profiles can be derived by applying that score. And so some patients may be interested in deriving that information, and your provider can get that information for you. Now, the diagnosis of mantle cell is not particularly hard anymore. We can do special tests for this 11-14 translocation. We can do special tests to stain for the cyclin D1 protein. So it's not a very difficult diagnosis to make. Newly diagnosed patients need a full staging evaluation. Nowadays, most patients will get a PET scan, which is very useful imaging to tell you where the disease is in mantle cell lymphoma. Most patients will get a bone marrow evaluation. Some centers will do an upper and lower endoscopy to look for GI tract involvement. I don't do that routinely. It's fairly invasive, and so I usually don't need to know that unless the patient is having symptoms suggestive of significant GI involvement. When managing a patient with mantle cell lymphoma, really the first decision one has to make is how aggressive or intensive to be with the treatment. And here's the principle. Intensive treatments, at least in younger patients, tend to produce longer first remissions. They're harder to get through, so there's more toxicity and there's more side effects while you're going through the treatment, but there's a trade-off. because you often buy yourself a longer first remission, which means you get to go a longer period of time before you have to consider second-line therapies and third-line therapies, and that's really the trade-off when deciding between intensive and non-intensive. In my experience and in my review of the literature, once patients get around age 65, I don't find intensive strategies worth it anymore. Older patients have a lot more difficult time tolerating intensive strategies, and the toxicities, I think, start to outweigh the benefits. And when I've looked at the data for intensive strategies used in patients over the age of 65, I don't think the outcomes are that good, and I think there are non-intensive strategies that can produce comparable outcomes. So when I have patients over the age of 65, I will typically recommend a non-intensive strategy for managing their disease. Patients between the age of 60 and 65 are kind of on the fence in my mind, and I'll look at their underlying health and their comorbid conditions. I'll look at things like the MIPI score and the Ki-67 and trying to decide whether to pursue an intensive or a non-intensive strategy. And then as a rule of thumb, patients under the age of 60, I will generally talk to them and recommend a non-intensive, I will recommend an intensive treatment strategy for younger patients. Occasionally, you'll have younger patients who choose not to do an intensive strategy, and I do think that's okay. It's not a wrong strategy. They just have to understand that their first remission, probably wouldn't last quite as long as it would had they chosen an intensive strategy. So what do I mean by intensive and non-intensive? A typical example of a non-intensive treatment strategy would be something like the bendamustine-rituximab combination. Bendamustine is a chemotherapy drug. Rituximab is a monoclonal antibody. Those two together work very well. And that treatment in older mantle cell patients will put 85 to 90% of people in remission, and on average, those remissions tend to last in the 3.5-year range, which is a pretty good outcome. There may be a role for maintenance rituximab after that kind of induction. That's an area of controversy. Maintenance rituximab has been shown to prolong remission duration after different inductions, like R-CHOP chemotherapy. The problem is R-CHOP does not work as well as bendamustine rituximab. And so most of us do not like to use R-CHOP for our mantle cell patients because the remissions tend to be brief. The question is, will maintenance rituximab produce the same benefit after bendamustine rituximab therapy? There was one small study presented this year suggesting that maintenance rituximab is not beneficial, but it was a very small study, and I don't think it was definitive, even close to definitive. So I personally am still administering maintenance rituximab for 2 years after bendamustine rituximab therapy for older mantle cell lymphoma patients. Another consideration is a very innovative strategy that was published this last year from a group of investigators that look at giving lenalidomide, which is an oral drug, plus rituximab as initial treatment for mantle cell lymphoma. This was a small study, but it produced impressive outcomes. And I think this is an option, but the number of patients studied and the follow-up is small, and the follow-up is short. So I'm not recommending that strategy yet for my older patients with mantle cell lymphoma, and I'm waiting to see how that data matures and evolves before I would recommend that to my patients. For the younger patients who could be candidates for intensive treatments, so what do I mean by intensive? Well, that would be anything that includes a stem cell transplant as part of the treatment package or a highly aggressive chemotherapy regimen. There's a regimen called HyperCVAD with alternating methotrexate cytarabine. That's a regimen that's commonly used for acute leukemia. That's been shown to be a pretty good regimen in mantle cell lymphoma. It's very intensive, so that would be an example of an intensive strategy. So there are several examples of intensive regimens, and most of these produce first remission lengths that average right around 5 years. For example, R-CHOP followed by stem cell transplant gets you right around 5-year first remission on average. But there is some new data that has come out in the past 18 months or so that suggest that if patients receive an induction chemotherapy regimen that includes a drug called cytarabine given at high doses and then receives the stem cell transplant, that the median remission duration now can get above 7 years. So examples of these regimens would be things like the Nordic regimen or a regimen called R-CHOP with alternating R-DHAP followed by stem cell transplant. These regimens have produced median, we call it progression-free survival, that is an estimate of the first remission length, of a little over 7 years for younger mantle cell patients. So these are the best results reported to date. So if I have a younger patient who I think is a candidate for an intensive strategy, that's the kind of strategy that I will talk to them about and recommend to them. Because if you even get the average result of 7.5 years, that gives you, the patient, 7 years that you require no additional treatment. It gives the field 7 years to make new discoveries. It gives your doctor 7 years to get a little smarter so that the next time you might need treatment, we'll have better options. So I really like the idea of getting a nice, long first remission so that hopefully we have even better options for that day where we may need to treat that patient again. So the last thing I'll just conclude with is just a word about healthcare communication issues and quality of life issues. I think this whole notion of intensive versus non-intensive treatment really highlights the quality of life issue. And it really is a true trade-off. Patients who choose an intensive treatment strategy are going to have a worse quality of life while they are going through the treatment, compared to a treatment who chooses a non-intensive treatment strategy. However, some of the non-intensive treatment strategies go on for a very long duration. So the stem cell transplant strategy, your quality of life may be diminished substantially for 9 months or so, but it could be very good a year later, whereas someone on a non-intensive strategy where the treatment goes on for, say, 2 or 3 years, say with maybe the lenalidomide rituximab combination, you don't feel so tired or wore out while on therapy, but you feel that way for the whole 3 years. So it truly is a complicated discussion. You really have to talk this through with your physician. You have to think about your goals and your values and what's important to you. Would you rather front load your toxicity and get it over with, or would you rather spread it out over a longer period of time? There's truly no right or wrong answer to those questions. I think different patients can come to different conclusions, and this will require a very thoughtful conversation with your healthcare team before making that decision. And I think with that, I'll conclude, and I'll turn it back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Carl. That was really very comprehensive, very eloquent, really covered so much, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Leslie Popplewell. Dr. Popplewell is Associate Clinical Professor, Department of Hematology and Hematopoietic Cell Transplantation, City of Hope. And Dr. Popplewell is going to address treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, emerging treatment approaches, and clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Popplewell.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you also, Dr. Call. That was a great summary of the upfront approach to mantle cell lymphoma. And I was just mentioning to Dr. Messner before we got started today that there are so many more things to talk about now than there were 10 or 15 years ago. The survival has gotten much better for mantle cell lymphoma, and I think that a number of years ago, mantle cell lymphoma was recognized as sort of an unmet need. We didn't have a lot of specific treatments for this kind of lymphoma, but we do now. And, it seems like every year, every couple of years, there's a new drug or a new drug combination that we need to incorporate somehow into our overall strategy. And it's nice to have, that kind of a challenge. So I am going to talk about some treatment options for patients who have mantle cell lymphoma that have relapsed after their first treatment. And then I'll talk about some of the newer treatment options that, you know, may be getting more popular or possibly haven't been fully approved yet by the FDA. And then I'll talk a little bit also about clinical trials. So I'll start by just echoing Dr. Call's mention that we really don't think that we have a cure as yet for mantle cell lymphoma. I think we're getting closer to that. But really, with the possible exception of allogeneic transplant, the available therapies for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma are not curative, just like the upfront treatments are not necessarily curative. I have a lot of patients I've been following for many years, and you know we always hope they stay in remission, but we don't really know what's going to happen. So it's always nice for you as a doctor or for your doctor to sort of have an idea in mind. You know, my patient's been in remission for a number of years, but if I had to make a decision tomorrow about what to do next, what would my decision be? So that tends to be the way that I think about strategizing these. And things that we have to think about for patients who have relapsed disease is how do we sequence these newer treatments? And, you know, what are the things that are better to use up front? Maybe we should wait and use some of the treatments later because they have more side effects. And we don't want to wind up burning any bridges for treating patients by using certain things up front, or I shouldn't say up front, but for relapse disease. So just to move ahead, you know, there are a number of regimens or treatments that are available for patients with relapse disease. There's really no established preferred order. So we have something called the National Cancer Center Network that publishes guidelines for treatment of many different kinds of cancer, and mantle cell lymphoma is one of them. And so, you know, basically a group of experts have gotten together and decided, you know, we have certain options for treatment, but treatment has to be individualized. So I'm not going to present these in any particular order, but I'll just go through them one by one. And I'm going to use a lot of terms of some newer drugs that some of you might be familiar with and others might not. So I'll just start out by saying that, you know, Dr. Call had mentioned the treatment options of R-CHOP or bendamustine with Rituxan. Those are still treatment options that are available for patients who have relapsed disease. We tend not to go back and repeat a treatment that's already been done, though. So oftentimes we'll choose a treatment for a patient who's relapsed based on what they've already had before. So we try not to repeat that. Some of the drugs we can't repeat because the treatments the cumulative effect of the drug is not good. But we might consider doing another treatment if it's been, you know, 5 or 7 years since they had seen that prior therapy. So, you know, as an example, bendamustine and rituximab has a very high response rates in patients with relapse disease who had their initial treatment with R-CHOP, but these days more people are getting bendamustine and rituxan up front, and so it's hard to know, you know, if you used BR up front, what would happen if you used R-CHOP as second-line therapy. But both of them are very acceptable regimens to use for patients with relapse disease. And these are sort of, you know, traditional chemotherapy regimens. You know, you get an IV infusion of one or more drugs. The cycles are repeated every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks. And then, you know, generally you have an idea up front of how many cycles you might consider doing. You don't do an unlimited number of cycles. But those two treatment options are a little bit different from some of the newer regimens that are available. The newer regimens that are available tend to be used for longer periods of time. And it's nice that we now have not only IV infusional therapies, you know, with all the expected side effects that we think of in terms of hair loss and nausea and other things that really impact our quality of life, but now we also have oral therapies and other modalities of treatment. So one of the newer therapies that has become available is an oral drug called ibrutinib. And ibrutinib is a pill and is generally given as a single agent. It's orally, basically you take it on a daily basis, and it can be combined with other drugs, but often is given by itself. So ibrutinib is one of the more exciting things to come around in the last several years. The overall response rate is very good. More patients get what we call a partial response than get a complete response. But you know, if we can decrease the burden of disease, that's always a positive thing. It hasn't really been directly compared with a lot of other agents, but we know that, you know, in phase 2 and phase 3 trials, the overall response rate has been high. And not only has it been high, but you know, it's been well tolerated. There's less benefit in patients who have what we call a blastoid variant of mantle cell lymphoma, but the vast majority of mantle cell patients don't have that that subtype. Another drug that has become available fairly recently, it's a little bit older than ibrutinib, is a drug called bortezomib. And bortezomib is it's systemically given, so it's not in a pill form. It can be given by IV or as a subcutaneous injection. And bortezomib is a kind of drug called a proteasome inhibitor. It's also FDA approved for patients with multiple myeloma. So we have a lot of experience using it in other settings as well. But bortezomib is another drug that's used. It can be used in combination with other agents, and there have been reports of combining it with CHOP chemotherapy. And there have been reports of using it with rituximab, although that does tend to result in higher toxicity. So one of the main side effects of bortezomib is that patients can get a neuropathy. They can get numbness of their fingers and toes, in addition to having low blood counts and things like that. Another of the newer therapies that I think Dr. Call had mentioned earlier is a drug called lenalidomide. And lenalidomide is another newer drug that's classified as an immune modulator. So lenalidomide is similar to thalidomide, which you might remember from years past. It's known for producing birth defects, and so there are special restrictions on administering lenalidomide. But it's an oral drug that seems to work very well in patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And lenalidomide is being combined with other drugs as well. And one of the nice things about some of these newer agents that I just mentioned is that, you know, you tend to know pretty quickly whether or not patients are responding to treatment. So you don't have to wait, you know, 6 months to be able to say, oh, yes, this patient's responding, or no, they aren't. So those are basically some newer drugs that have come out that we're using in patients with relapse disease. You know, of course, conventional chemotherapy is also available, but I've been talking more about some of the newer agents and some of the new classes of drugs. Dr. Call had earlier mentioned transplantation as an intervention for mantle cell lymphoma. Autologous transplant is what we call that when we collect the patient's own healthy stem cells, and then we give the patient high doses of chemotherapy and then give them their stem cells back. And so that is still an option, although we tend to use it up front in patients who are young and otherwise healthy, and the idea there is to give them the deepest remission possible. There have been reports of using autologous transplant in patients who have relapse disease, but the fact is that it really just doesn't work as well in that setting. So really, if you're going to think about using autologous transplant, you should think about using it up front. The other kind of transplant, though, that we often will talk about with patients is something called allogeneic transplant, where you're collecting healthy stem cells not from the patient but from another individual. It might be a brother, sister, or it might be an unrelated donor who is identified through the National Marrow Donor Program. And, you know, in that case, you know, again, we're collecting healthy stem cells from the donor. The patient is admitted to the hospital. They often get chemotherapy that's high dose, but we can sometimes do low-dose chemotherapy or low-dose radiation to help get them ready for the transplant. And then the new cells are given to the patient. The difference between this and the autologous transplant is that these cells work by a slightly different mechanism. So in autologous transplant, we're usually just using the stem cells as a way to help them replenish their bone marrow after that high-dose chemotherapy. But with allogeneic transplant, those new cells also are able to have an anti-lymphoma effect, and we call that the graft versus disease effect. Unfortunately, the graft versus disease effect often goes hand in hand with the complication of transplant, and that's called graft versus host disease, where the patient is the host and the graft are the new cells. And even though we always choose the very best match possible for a patient, sometimes those cells will recognize differences between the patient and the donor, and healthy parts of the body can be attacked as well. And that's something that we try to head off before it can even start, but we're not always successful at that, and we're getting better at treating graft versus host disease, but you know, it's a complication that that we have to be aware of. And so, you know, graft versus host disease and infections are a couple of the reasons that that allogeneic transplant hasn't really become the main way of dealing with mantle cell lymphoma, because you know, there are, because of the risks that are involved. Radiation therapy has been used for treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. One of the other newer emerging therapies for mantle cell lymphoma are CAR T cells. And so this sort of segues into the clinical trials section of the talk. So some of you may know a lot already about clinical trials. Clinical trials are really the way that we get a really objective view of how new drugs or new treatments will work for a variety of patients. So basically, when you have a new drug or a new intervention, you say, what's the best way we can say whether this is really working or not? So you try to get a group of patients who all have the same disease and the same characteristics, and you treat those patients. So there are early phase clinical trials where drugs are maybe very new in development, where you're really looking at, you know, what's the best dose and what's the safest dose that we can give patients. Or you might be talking about a phase two trial in which you've already decided what the best dose and the best way of giving the drug is, and now you're saying, well, what's the overall response rate? How well does this really work if we give this, are able to give the same dose to every single patient? And that often will segue into a phase three trial where you say, well, we have this new treatment and we know how well this works when it's given, but really if we have a head-to-head comparison, how well does the new drug work compared to the old drug? So that's when you get into randomizing patients and saying, you'll either get the new treatment or the old treatment. And some of those clinical trials are blinded, meaning that neither the patient nor the treating physician know what the patient is getting. But more often, the randomization happens and everybody knows what's going to happen afterwards. We can't control what arm a patient goes on, but it's often not a secret what they're getting. So clinical trials are an important way to move the field forward, to get these new drugs available to more patients. They're often a thing that patients can access in order to get some of the newer treatments sooner than some other people. It's always something that really requires a lot of careful discussion. And so we spend a lot of time counseling patients on the potential risks and benefits of treatment before they enroll on a clinical trial. So one of the clinical trials that we and many other centers have been working on are the use of these CAR T cells, where we take some of the patient's own healthy T lymphocytes and insert genetic information into those T lymphocytes to make them express a receptor on their surface so that they can go around and they can attach themselves to diseased B lymphocytes like lymphoma cells, and we can have those cells go and attack the lymphoma. So the CAR T cells are early in development, but they're moving along at a rapid pace, and it may be that these cells are going to be available more widely. They've been evaluated more in patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia and other kinds of lymphoma, but there is one trial that's being conducted, at least one trial right now, that's being conducted specifically for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And so I think with that, my time is up, might be a little bit over, so I'll at this point turn things over to Dr. Messner again, and thank you for your attention and time.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Popplewell. That was really, really extraordinary, excellent, and lots of wonderful information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Maxwell Mulcahy. Mr. Mulcahy is Senior Director of Patient and Professional Programs, Lymphoma Research Foundation, and he will be addressing the Lymphoma Research Foundation programs and conferences, as well as the LRF helpline. It's my pleasure now. And he also has, and of course, the Lymphoma Research Foundation has played a key role in actually the whole development of this program and support of it. So I also want to just thank him for that again. And now I turn this program over to Mr. Mulcahy.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and to Cancer Care for our continued partnership. I also want to thank our esteemed faculty, Dr. Brad Call, who serves on the Lymphoma Research Foundation Scientific Advisory Board. And Dr. Call also chairs LRF's Mantle Cell Lymphoma Scientific Consortium. In addition, thank you to Dr. Leslie Popplewell, who is also a member of this consortium, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I want to thank you both for sharing your time and expertise today, and for all that you do to support the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by mantle cell lymphoma. I also want to acknowledge our corporate sponsorship sponsors, Celgene Corporation and Takeda Oncology, for supporting today's call. And last but not least, I would like to thank all of you for joining our call today and hearing this valuable information. As some of you may know, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest organization devoted to funding innovative lymphoma research and serving the lymphoma community. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by the disease, and we achieve this mission by providing comprehensive education programs, outreach initiatives, and patient services. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying potentially life-saving therapies through an aggressively funded research program that's guided by LRF scientific leadership, who are among the world's leading experts in lymphoma. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and has played a key role in accelerating the understanding and treatment of mantle cell lymphoma through our renowned Mantle Cell Consortium, which is comprised of more than 100 scientists from North America, Europe, and around the world who are dedicated to advancing NCL research. To date, LRF has funded nearly $60 million in lymphoma-specific research, and the foundation also remains committed to providing comprehensive disease-specific resources, programs, and services to those who have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. And some of these resources include our Lymphoma Helpline, where professionally trained staff can assist you in your search for mantle cell disease and treatment information, as well as resources and other services. A clinical trials information service, which provides information on clinical trials, and then we do the legwork to help identify a trial that's appropriate for your diagnosis and in your geographic area. And we also offer a lymphoma support network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that pairs lymphoma patients and caregivers with others who have had a similar lymphoma experience. Disease specificity is a hallmark of the foundation, and we offer a variety of mantle cell lymphoma-specific resources. And these also include a comprehensive disease booklets and guides, disease-specific fact sheets on mantle cell lymphoma in both the frontline and refractory settings, as well as on supportive care, information, disease-specific e-newsletters, webcasts, podcasts, and videos, a dedicated mantle cell lymphoma website, and the URL for that is www.focusonmcl.org, which offers disease and treatment information, as well as inspiring stories from mantle cell lymphoma survivors. And we also offer an award-winning mobile app called Focus on Lymphoma. The app provides patients and caregivers with comprehensive biology and treatment information on their lymphoma subtype, as well as tools to help manage their diagnosis and treatment side effects. The Focus on Lymphoma mobile app allows users to record doctor sessions, manage medications, track blood work, and document treatment side effects. And it's available for free download in the Apple App Store and in Google Play. And so I'd encourage everybody to download this free app today. I hope you take advantage of some of these great resources and services. I also want to invite you to please join us on November 17th from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time for an important teleconference on the advances in immunotherapy. And for more information on LRF's mantle cell lymphoma programs and services and resources, or to register for this upcoming immunotherapy teleconference, please call our helpline toll-free at 800-500-9976, or you can also visit our website, which is www.lymphoma.org. Thank you very much for your time today. And I'll call back over to Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Max. That was really wonderful and just a wonderful resource. I know many of you on the call are familiar with the Lymphoma Research Foundation, but if you're not, it's just really, it has everything you're going to need about lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma. And so definitely all that Max has identified is just so, it's really so innovative and so many programs, so please take advantage of them. I'm just going to say a word about cancer care. Basically, cancer care is a nonprofit organization that provides national services to people living with cancer, and those services really are practical and financial assistance, as well as counseling services provided by trained oncology social workers. And so we offer programs on all different types of cancer, including lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma, and we specifically, though, the focus is really on providing a chance to talk with someone about your concerns or your dealing with your disease on a practical basis, either in terms of just talking to others about your cancer, disclosure issues, workplace issues, talking with children or grandchildren about your mantle cell lymphoma, the kinds of just day-to-day issues that come up when you're dealing with a cancer diagnosis, a mantle cell lymphoma diagnosis. And you can contact us using our 800 number, which is, I think, all of your literature, and I'll actually conclude mentioning it again, and also our website as well, but just a lot of different kinds of services that you can access. So now we do have time for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I'm going to talk at the end of how you can get your questions answered. And so I think I'm going to ask Andrea to bring all of our speakers at this point on board to answer your questions. And actually, Andrea is going to explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Marcia G. Your line is open.
We're still on? Yes, this is her husband.
Oh, yes, thank you. And your question? Yes.
The question to the doctors is, there's a lot of new gene editing tools come out, and one of them is this CRISPR-Cas9. And our question is it, would it be useful in working with lymphoma diseases?
Excellent. Thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Kahl if you could address that question in a general way.
Well, to take advantage of a technology like that, you need access to cells from the patient that you could genetically manipulate. So You obviously can't access all the tumor cells in a patient, but you might be able to access some cells of the patient's immune system that you can genetically manipulate and then infuse back into the patient. That's exactly what is done with the CAR T-cell therapy that Dr. Popowell mentioned. And so I suppose it's conceivable that this kind of technology could be used to genetically modify cells of the patient's immune system, but I actually would like to hear Dr. Popowell's thought on that as well.
Yeah, I agree with you that probably modifying immune cells is a better tool for that. It's almost impossible to really directly treat a patient with that kind of technology. But I think as a research tool, it's going to be, you know, a wonderful addition. So I think something like that is right now more useful for sort of more basic research. And the more we know about lymphoma and how it behaves and how it develops, the more we're going to have ideas on how to effectively treat it. So right now, you know, that's a newer technology and it's being used, you know, in a more basic way. But I think it will, you know, come into play in lymphoma.
All right, excellent. So we have some questions from our online participants. I'm going to start with Warren's. It was actually the first online question we got early in the program. I'd like your opinion about MRD testing, liquid biopsy, for patients in remission after first treatment but not in clinical trial. Dr. Kaur, could you address that question?
Sure. So for those on the call who don't know, MRD stands for minimal residual disease, and we have very sensitive ways to look for very small amounts of cancer in the blood or in the bone marrow. And depending on the technology you use, you might be able to find one cancer cell in a background of 10,000 normal cells. Or you might be able to find one cancer cell in a background of 100,000 normal cells. Or even one cancer cell in a background of 1,000,000 normal cells. And so there's a lot of interest right now in using that technology and those techniques to assess the quality of response to a particular line of treatment. So maybe a simple way to explain it is imagine that you treat two patients in the exact same way, and they both appear to have a complete response by our conventional strategies like PET scanning. But you do this MRD test off the blood or off the bone marrow, and one of the patients is, quote, MRD negative, meaning you could not find a cancer cell in one in a million, in a background of one in a million cells, and in the other patient you could, and they were, quote, MRD positive. The presumption there is that the patient who is MRD negative has an even better quality remission than the patient who still remains MRD positive. Now, what to do with that information is the big unknown. It's pretty clear in other diseases like chronic lymphocytic leukemia and in acute leukemia that MRD negativity predicts a better outcome, but we don't always know what to do with that information, and that's kind of the next step. So, as an example, we're designing a big national study right now that'll look at patient's MRD status after intensive induction therapy, and we'll try to use that information to decide if the patient should go on to stem cell transplantation or not. So we're about to initiate studies that would try to take advantage of that information. To date, we don't exactly know how to use that information.
Thank you. Our next question, again, this is for Dr. Popowell, an online question. What is your approach for treating relapsed patients who experienced late-onset neutropenia from rituximab during initial treatment? If you could answer that, Dr. Popowell, in a general way.
Late-onset neutropenia from rituximab?
From rituximab during
yeah.
initial treatment.
So that is a complication that is not very common, but it is well recognized. And, you know, my general approach is to interrupt therapy. You know, rituximab has a long half-life, meaning that, you know, even, you know, a number of weeks, even a month or 8 weeks after after a dose of rituximab, it's still in your system. So, you know, I think for those patients, interrupting therapy, holding the rituximab, trying to support the patient's white blood cell count with growth factors like Neupogen is the best approach. And then you have to think about whether using rituximab in the future is a good idea. Most patients do eventually, you know, recover from that. You know, often if I see that this is going on for a little while, I'll do a bone marrow biopsy just to find out what's happening in the marrow, because we often have a good idea that that's what's going on, but we don't really know. So it's nice to look in and make sure that you're not going to find a lot of lymphoma in the bone marrow or some other reason why the counts are poor.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question also from one of our residents. When they registered, this was a question they had up front. I have extreme dry eyes, now causing blurred vision and constant discomfort. I also have mouth sores and a skin rash over 40% of my body. What can I do? So this, again, is an individual question. I'm wondering, Dr. Kahl, if you could just address it in a general way in terms of the treatment side effect, which is how this is being presented, if you could comment on that.
Well, I guess I'm curious as to whether this is a complication of a prior therapy. It almost, I'm speculating that patient who submitted the question may have had an allogeneic stem cell transplant and is suffering some complications of graft versus host. Potentially, though, that can lead to those sorts of complications. And Dr. Popowell is probably a better person to answer that question than I am in that scenario. But usually the management is symptom-directed at the specific site. So lubricants for dry eyes, steroids or topical steroids for the rash. I forget what the third symptom was.
Mouth sores.
Yeah, that's a hard one to deal with. There are medications for pain, topical medications as well as oral medications that can help with mouth sore discomfort. So if it's a complication of an allotransplant, those are some of the strategies. If it's a complication of standard chemotherapy, usually those are transient, temporary things that get better once the acute effects of the treatment wears off.
And Dr. Popowell, did you want to comment as well?
Well, yeah, I agree. The first thing I thought when I heard these symptoms were, oh, chronic graft-versus-host disease from an allogeneic transplant. But I don't know for sure if that's what this is, so it's hard to answer. But, you know, in that case, generally, you know, immunosuppressive medications are given, and there are a lot of topical therapies for dry eyes and skin rash. So we have a graft versus host disease clinic here, where, you know, patients who have GVH that's difficult to manage are seen by a specialized team that includes a, you know, dermatologist and our transplant physicians, and we bring in other specialists as well.
Thank you. I hope that's helpful then. Thank you. These are excellent responses here. And we've got a question from another online participant from Freeman. Do median remission times start from the date first-line therapy is completed or from the date of diagnosis? Dr. Popowell, would you like to address that question?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yes. Do median remission time start from the date first-line therapy is completed or from the date of diagnosis?
The median remission times date from the time that you start treating the patients. But, I mean, if you're talking about upfront therapy, usually patients start getting treated shortly after they're diagnosed. If you're talking about a patient who's had a relapse disease, then you gauge the remission time from when you started treating the patient.
Yeah, if you don't mind, Leslie, I'm going to add to what you just said, because this can be very confusing for patients. So to the people on the call, you might hear two terms used from time to time, and they're similar, but they're not identical. So you'll hear median progression-free survival a lot, and that is an estimate of remission length. that is measured in all patients on a study, and the clock starts when the patients register for the study, whether it's a frontline therapy or a second-line treatment, but the clock starts before the treatment is initiated, and it's measured in all patients. So if you have 100 patients, you're measuring all 100 of them for their remission length. There's another term that you'll sometimes see called response duration. That's different than progression-free survival, response duration. So imagine you took the same 100 patients, and imagine 50 of them responded to the treatment and 50 didn't. Now you're just going to measure the remission duration or response duration, same thing, of those 50 patients who responded. That clock starts at end of treatment when you've established that they're in remission. And you're measuring it in a subset of the whole number. You're just measuring it in the responders. So sometimes you'll see response duration, and that's the latter scenario. Sometimes you'll see progression-free survival. That was the first scenario that I gave you.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you both. Excellent. It's wonderful to have two experts addressing a question. It's really, I know that's a very rare situation for many of you to experience, so we really appreciate that. And this will be our last question. It's from Adam, and it's for Dr. Popplewell. Can you please talk about ibrutinib resistance and about the ibrutinib plus palbociclib clinical trial, PALBOCICLIB clinical trial? Is this
palbociclib? Okay, so yeah, I'm not sure that I can answer about the trial, but for in terms of ibrutinib resistance, so ibrutinib, you know, is this oral drug which is relatively newly available. So you may be talking about the fact that some patients, when they relapse after ibrutinib, tend to have a more difficult course. So it's not really clear. We don't know all the mechanisms of ibrutinib resistance, but for some reason, if you've progressed while you're on ibrutinib, it may just be a manifestation of more aggressive disease, and it's sort of the nature of lymphoma over time to change. Different lymphoma cells may develop resistance to certain agents, and you know what we see is that over time lymphoma may begin to behave more aggressively. So it may be that the ability of lymphoma to break through while on ibrutinib therapy is just an indication that event has occurred. I'm not sure if I can tell you about the combination. It sounds like you're describing a drug that's a CDK inhibitor. Right now ibrutinib is available, and the next step is to figure out how best to combine it with other novel agents to get even better results. And there are a number of studies, ibrutinib plus drug A, plus drug B, plus drug C. And, you know, we're all excited to find out what will happen when those results are reported out.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal, excellent. I want to thank all of you who've asked questions during this program, because it's enhanced the program tremendously with your questions, and all of you who've been listening. Now, I do want to thank our speakers, and I also want to recognize again the Lymphoma Research Foundation for their really support of this program. And so the questions that you may have that you didn't, because we do have more questions here in queue, and we also have those of you who may develop a question tomorrow and the weeks ahead. So for any questions about mantle cell lymphoma, about lymphoma in general, I would definitely recommend that you go ahead and call the Lymphoma Research Foundation helpline, 1-800-500-9976, 1-800-500-9976. And I know that they will be most able to help you with getting answers to your questions, getting you materials to help answer your questions, all the materials that Mr. Mulcahy mentioned, making those available to you. So that will be just a wonderful resource for everybody on the call. And for those of you who might like to pursue just getting some financial assistance or practical help or counseling services, please go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, and our staff will be happy to assist you with just someone to talk to about your concerns or worries in just coping with mantle cell lymphoma, lymphoma in general, or cancer in general. Most importantly, as we conclude today's program, we don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with mantle cell lymphoma or lymphoma in general. We want you to know that you're now part of the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care community. And by being so, we're simply really a telephone call away or visiting our websites as well. These are very quick ways to access us. And you don't have to wait until you're terribly worried or concerned. You can just call us anytime you wish. These are free services, and they really are available to all of you. So we hope you'll take advantage of that. And we know that, in the course of the day, you do have concerns. And just, don't hesitate to call. It's always nice to have an external person to call. And in addition to that, we definitely want to refer you back to your treating healthcare team. And I can't say enough about that. You've had a chance to ask questions, and, of course, the questions our speakers did give you some general responses to your questions, but take that information and the information that you learned on this call today back to your treating healthcare team so that you can have a discussion with them also about what your needs are, to be as open with them as possible about your concerns. That's very important as well. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.